So, I would like to dedicate this shiur. Tonight is the 10th of Adar. It's the Yortzeit of Yocheved Liba Bat Yehuda. It's a longer story. It's not my place to tell it. But I think it's important to know. I hope I'm not being Masik Gvul here. That Rav Judah, many years ago, they lost a child. The child was Zochet to live 2 days. It's absolutely remarkable that a person can develop such a kesher with a neshama when they only really knew them for 2 days. And this is her yahrzeit tonight. One thing you can say about a child that leaves this world is that their neshama was pure. Like a person who lives here only for 2 days, they had no purpose here but to bring joy and meaning and thought. And they have no chataim. It's pure neshama. So giving an ilui to such a neshama is actually a schus, a big merit, because you're elevating a pure neshama, right? So we could talk about that more, but this year is dedicated to Yocheved Liba Bat Yehuda's neshama. Later, the Q&A, and because tomorrow all day is her yahrzeit, you know, if you have a karas tov to Rav Yehuda for all the Torah that he shares here, this is really an opportunity to give something back to him that I know would be meaningful to him, you know, to learn tomorrow something lilui, or do a mitzvah lilui neshama. We just came back from Poland, some of us, and we, you know, some of us here in Israel had all sorts of different experiences. And there's an unbelievable story that I heard many years ago that I didn't understand. And only in Poland with Rav Yitzchak, actually a couple years ago, did I also, you know, you have that story, it's in your head, that question you don't get, and then something else sort of comes to your life, and all of a sudden, it pops. You suddenly realize what it was all about. So, I met a fellow once. I remember his name was Yaakov. I don't remember his last name. It was many years ago. And Rabbi Yaakov, he shared with me an interesting story. You know, I told you once that whenever I meet someone who's a survivor, I always ask them all sorts of questions if I feel they're open to sharing. How did you get out? When did you decide? How did you survive? Where were you? And sometimes you get into a discussion with somebody and say, if you could pick some reason that you survived. I mean, the life expectancy for a Jew in Auschwitz in the labor camp was 3 months. Like, if you survived the selections, and you think about the malnutrition, the cold, the terrible conditions, the beatings, if a person survived more than 3 months, that was above average. And you meet lots of survivors who survived 10 months, a year and a half. Unbelievable. I've met people who lived 5 years in the camps. You don't know how they did it. These were the strongest of the strong. It's not an accident that those people came here and they built the State of Israel. They were. It was Adolf Hitler's system for survival of the fittest. So, but sometimes you get an answer that stands in your mind. And I asked this fellow, you know, how he survived. And he said it was very simple. Netilas Yadayim. I said, Netilas Yadayim? What do you mean, Netilas Yadayim? Washing your hands. He said, yeah. He said, I was a Slonim Mechassid. And sometime before the war, out of the blue, the current Slonim Rebbe, not the Nesivos, but the one who was in the 20s, Yad Avram, I think, he suddenly said to all the Chassidim, you should just know that whatever travails you go through, the Yisurin, make sure you always know till Netilas Yadayim. Always do Netilas Yadayim. If you do Netilas Yadayim, if your hands are pure, your life will be pure, and you can get through anything. So it's a strange thing to say, to do Netilas Yadayim. And, you know, he was a young man. He forgot about it. And then later, when they were in the camps, he was grasping on anything that he could remember, and this thought came into his head. And he remembered what the Slonimer had said. And he decided that to the degree he was able, he's going to be makvid on Netilas Yadayim in the morning when he woke up. Couldn't do it all day, then makvid. He was going to be careful about doing Netilas Yadayim. Now, those of you who are with us in Poland may remember that after we were next to the barracks where Jakey's great-grandmother survived, Rav Yitzchak turned us around and showed us another barracks that was destroyed, but you could very clearly see the rows of toilets that were destroyed. And he began to describe to us what it meant to go to the toilets. And the reason he recognized this was because the latrine barrack was a separate hut. And there was water in this latrine barrack. And technically speaking, the Nazis were fastidious about cleanliness. So you were allowed to go and wash yourself in the morning. And you could go to the bathroom. The problem was that in order to go to the bathroom or go wash yourself, right, you had to run a gauntlet. And very often the Ukrainian guards, Lithuanian guards, they would hide there and they would ambush you. Sometimes they would just start peppering you with questions. Remember, a lot of these Jews had dysentery. They had terrible diseases. By the time they got to the bathrooms, they were like desperate to go sit in the bathroom, you know? And then someone starts to ask you questions and eventually you explode. You know, you can't. And the horror of that. And then he describes to us what it was. You know, there's no stall. There's no door. You're sitting in a hole in the middle of a hut. And you're very often, in order to position yourself, you're leaning against the guy behind you. There's no privacy, there's no dignity, there's no decency. Very often you got to the toilet and the fellow before you had soiled himself or you were sitting in there. It was a horrible thing. What did you use for toilet paper? So I remember actually the survivor was there who told us that she ripped a rag off of her shirt, of her uniform. She kept it in her pocket. And if every couple of weeks she managed to wash it somehow, then that was considered good. Like usually, like we can't even imagine that. Now, in order to wash your hands in the morning, you had to run from the barracks in the little time you had. You had to get up there. You had to risk a beating. And you had to use that precious time after barely any sleep. And remember that in the winter it was freezing cold. And the water was freezing cold. So we don't even begin to understand the mysterious nefesh, the sacrifice, the willingness to sacrifice that a person had to have to do Netilas Yadayim even once in Auschwitz. This fellow told me that he managed to do Netilas Yadayim every single day that he was there. And I didn't understand that. I thought, wow, that's so cool. And I wanted to ask him, how did you do that? He said, there was a latrine. And I had to go, but I made it my business to do Netilas Yadayim. I thought, oh, why don't you keep the mitzvah? I didn't understand until I was there with Yitzchak, just what that meant. So I want you to put that story in the back of your head. Right? And I want to share with you an idea. We're in Parshat Tetzaveh, right? There are a couple of interesting things about Parshat Tetzaveh. The first is, everybody knows, right? What's missing in Parshat Tetzaveh? What's missing in this week's portion? Pardon? Moshe's name, right? Moshe is missing from Parshat Tetzaveh. Does anybody know why? This is the only Parsha since the birth of Moshe in the Torah that does not mention Moshe's name. Does anybody know why Moshe's name is not in the Parsha? Yeah? Exactly. Hashem says, right, Teref mimeni v'ash midem. Leave me, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people. And Moshe says, if you destroy the Jewish people, mecheni nami sifrecha. Erase me from your book. That's a puzzle. So the rabbis teach us that when a tzaddik says something, part of what he says has to be fulfilled. And therefore, I'm not going to get into what the meaning behind that idea is. Be careful what you say, though, right? If you're a tzaddik, right? And therefore, there had to be some erasure. So, from one parsha, Moshe's name is erased. Right? Now, what's the obvious question? Why this parsha? Why this portion? So, put that in the other corner of your head. If Moshe's name had to be erased, why this portion? Well, you couldn't erase him from the portion of the Exodus from Egypt. It wouldn't make sense to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim without talking about Moshe. But why this portion? Okay? Having said that Moshe's name is missing from this portion, now that we've said that, and that's true, now we can also say it's really not true. Because where does Moshe appear in this portion? Who said that? The Atah. Who is Hashem talking to when he says, you shall command the Jewish people? Moshe. Now, when you refer to someone without their name, right, you think about what a name is. You know, I don't use my name. You use my name. You know, I don't come into this and says, Binny says we should all have Shir now because I'm talking about me. I don't think of myself as Binny. It's funny to me to even say the word. How often do you say that? You think of me. I just think of me as me. And when I think of me as me, that me is different from anybody else because I'm seeing it through me. So ve'ata is the essence of you. It's not just the name of you. When you know someone's name, it doesn't mean you know who they are. Right? It means you can designate that you're talking about them as opposed to everybody else. But you don't really know a person just because you know his name. You're just starting to get to know him. But you get to a point, right? Like if you say to your wife, if you marry a girl named Yocheved Leah Rachel, you don't have to say, I love you, Yocheved Leah Rachel. You say, I love you, I love who you are. I don't just love your name, right? I don't remember the last time talking to my wife. I don't remember the last time I had a day that I didn't tell my wife I loved her. But I don't remember the last time I said, I love you, Dorit. Like, I don't have to say that. So, V'ata is the essence. Why is this parsha the essence of Moshe? Okay? So, I'm going to share with you an interesting idea that relates to this. So, what is this mitzvah? What is the mitzvah that Moshe is told to command the Jewish people? By the way, it's interesting. Usually God commands, and then he says it to Moshe, and Moshe repeats it, right? Daber al bnei Israel, speak to the Jewish people and tell them, and this is my command, right? Here, Hashem is actually saying, you need to command this. Now, one way of understanding, you understand the question. Like, Moshe doesn't command, Hashem commands. And if Hashem is commanding Moshe to command, then it is really Hashem's command. So why is it written as Moshe's command? As Moshe's imperative? Because perhaps the essence of this mitzvah stems from the essence of who Moshe is. We will understand this mitzvah. We will be able to receive this mitzvah because of who Moshe Rabbeinu is. It's the fact that Moshe is Moshe and who he is that gives us this mitzvah. What is this mitzvah that is given to us by the essence of Moshe? Anybody know? Anybody else? Come on. Pardon? Well, it's the beginning of a parsha. You all have chumashim. Pardon? The oil. What kind of oil? What's oil for? The menorah. And by the way, there are two aspects of the menorah. There's lighting the candles of the menorah, and there's setting them up. And there's lighting the candles, and there's lighting a specific, perhaps the most Western, I'm not going to get into that discussion, that is also known as the, anybody know? I'll give you a hint. The Ner Tamid. This is the source of the concept of the Ner Tamid, the eternal flame that burns in the temple and therefore in synagogues to this day. As a halacha, by the way. So listen to this. They're going to take it to you. Right? Chassidus has a field day with this pasuk. Chassidus, what does it mean, v'ikhu elecha? They should take the elecha. They should take you. We have to take the essence of Moshe into us. Okay. Shemen zayit zach katit lamaor. You have to take pure olive oil. Katit. What does katit mean? Anybody know? Somebody know what katit means? Pardon? Sort of pounded. Okay? It's the first drop that comes out. Now, by the way, this is interesting. You actually don't crush the olive to get shemen that's katit, to get that first drop. Somebody know how this works? It's actually really interesting. In my neighborhood, they have found a number of olive presses that date back, one of them, to early Second Temple period. This was actually the place where they made the oil that serviced the menorah. It is pretty reasonable to assume that you can stand in front of an olive press that produced oil that was actually lit in the Beis HaMikdash. It's entirely possible that the actual oil that was given to the Chashmonaim that was for Hanukkah was taken from one of the olive presses that you can find. Now, why is it called an olive press? Because that's how they did this. They took a mat, and they laid the olives on the mat. Then they took another mat, and they laid the olives on that mat. And they had rows of mats with olives on them. Now, imagine that you have a pile yay high. Then they take a very heavy stone, and they put it on top of these mats gently, so that the weight of the stone is weighing down. And gradually, the weight pushes the olives, and the oil comes out. How they catch the oil is an interesting question. The first drops that come out of the oil, that's called shemen katit. That's the purest oil. Okay? Now, what could you use this oil for? What did you have to use this oil for? The menorah. Listen to this Rashi. Rashi says like this, zach, it should be pure, blish marim, without any sediments. Right, if you've ever seen olive oil, you ever go to like a restaurant and they got those little packets of olive oil for like the salad, and you got to shake it, right? Because you don't shake it, there's like schmutz that doesn't quite mix. That's sediments, that's shmarim, right? That's what oil has. But the first drop doesn't have that. It's pure. It's on the edge of the olive. It hasn't gotten stuff into it, right? Now listen to what Rashi says, right? Why do you have to do this, right? The eino tochnan barichayim. You don't grind it. You actually don't grind it. Right? Kedei shelo yebo shmarim, that it doesn't have sediment, it's not polluted. Now listen to this line.
V'yashemen hasheni pasul l'menorah. The oil that comes out next after that first drop is pasul. You're not allowed to use it for the menorah. This is Rashi. And this is how we rule halachically. This is, in fact, what we do. Right? V'kasher l'mnachot. But it's kosher for the sacrifices. Now that's interesting. Why would it be kosher for the sacrifices and not kosher for the menorah? I mean, think about it. By the way, when we say a mincha, right? You heard Rav Davidel's shir today on kmitza, on how I take a certain amount of flour with my three fingers, you know, right? There's a small amount. So that's part of a mincha. So it gets mixed with oil. And that mincha, that offering, which is basically a vegetable offering, it was the offering of the poor, it's an offering of gratitude. Wouldn't you think that you should use pure oil for that? So why are you allowed to use oil with sediment? So there are all sorts of discussions. This was the sacrifice of the poor. The poor can't afford the better oil, maybe. But there's a deeper idea here. And this is what I want to share with you. This comes in the Darash Moshe. Darash Moshe was a parish commentary that we have quoted before. It comes from Moshe Feinstein. Ah. Such a beautiful idea. It says like this. Rashi, velo katit l'menachot. Right? Rashi says that you don't have to use, you don't use this first oil for the carbon mincha, for these sacrifices. Hanush l'menachot kasher gam kshayu bo shmarim v'salku ha-shmarim min sha'azach. In other words, if you had sediments in the oil, it doesn't mean you should use the sediments for the offering. It means if you have oil with sediments, you can get rid of the sediments and use the oil. Once there's oil with sediment, that oil cannot be used for the menorah, right? But you can get out of the sediments and you can, okay, fine. Right? U'b'menorah, but for the menorah, tzarich she'me'olam lo ayu sham shmarim. It has to be that there were never shmarim, there were never pollutants in there. V'hu ki liyot moreh ha'am, u'lehan higam b'derech ha'torah. Because to lead, to teach, to be a role model, to share Torah, everything you do has to be pure. And everything you do has to not only be pure, it has to be perceived as pure. If I know that I'm doing something that's pure, but other people perceive it as impure, then I lose value as a role model. And the menorah, says Rav Moshe, represents Torah. Ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. That's what the pasuk says. Torah is light. And spreading light is what an educator is meant to do. And if you're a role model and you're an educator, then your actions have to be pure. Let me just finish this piece. Right? Lo achar she'yasbir masav. Not afterwards. Not that you do something, but then you can explain why it was okay. Your behavior has to be so sterling that there's nothing to explain. This is a very difficult level to reach. Most of the oil doesn't get there. The first drop does. Can we aspire to that? Can we aspire to that level? So that's number one. Number two, this is fascinating. Listen to this. I'm gonna read you a second piece from the Darash Moshe. What does the Darash Moshe say? So he says, if you look in, how many mizbechot, how many altars were there in the Beit HaMikdash? Anybody know?
Two.
Good. There were two. Does anybody know what they were called? One was the Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden altar. What was the other one? Mizbeach HaNechoshet, the copper altar. Now, where did these things sit? You're on the roof of a Raita. You're looking down on the Temple Mount. Okay? You see the Mizgad Al-Aqsa. You see the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Okay? Which is on the south side of the mountain. Right? Because it faces Mecca and Medina. The Muslims face south. And then you have the Gold Dome. The Gold Dome is actually not a mosque, because you can only build a mosque on the southern tip of a place. It's the dome that sits on a rock. What is that rock? That is called the Evan Shasia, or the Evan Yetzira. That is the foundation rock. That is where we believe, Jewish tradition says, Abraham offered up Isaac on a rock. That is where the Kabbalah, you know, tradition, Hasidus says, the world was created from one piece of matter. That's where it began. What is the most important aspect of knowing where that rock is? Anybody know? Because the Gemara says, the Talmud says, and also the Mishnah Midos, that the Kodesh Kadashim in the Holy of Holies was that rock. The Beis HaMikdash sat on that rock. So if that's that rock,
That's where the Beit HaMikdash was. Bar none. Now, by the way, that doesn't make it so easy because it's a pretty big rock, but whatever. Okay? All right. So you have, if I'm looking towards the Temple Mount, I have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and I have the Golden Dome, and the Golden Dome is where the Beit HaMikdash was. What was in between? Where the Al-Aqsa Mosque today is the edge of what Herod, King Herod, added on to the Temple Mount. Somewhere in the middle there was a gate called Shar Nicanor, and there were 15 steps. And we haven't discovered those steps yet. Anybody know why? Because we can't dig there. Whether we can't dig there because luckily we can't dig there, or we can't dig there because we'll start World War III, or anywhere in between, I'm not going to get into, but we haven't dug there, and therefore we haven't found it. Those 15 steps are pretty significant. They're the 15 steps that the Talmud says the Levium stood on in the morning, because Levium were, that was the edge of where the Levium could go, right? Actually, that's not true, but whatever. And they would enter sort of the stage beyond Shar Nicanor, and they would take one step up as they sang each Shira Malot. How many Shira Malot are there? 15, Kuf Lamed to Kuf Memei, right? And each one of them is called Shir HaMa'alot, the song of the ascents or the song of the steps, because that's where they sang them. And if you study those Shir HaMa'alot, and you study them from the perceptions of the Levium opening up the day with their instruments, it was a jam session. It was 15 Chadar Choshechs in broad daylight with the most unbelievable instruments. One of them, by the way, resembled the guitar. I'm not going to go there right now. It was like jam heaven. People would come from all over the world to watch this. The Levium had amazing voices. They probably picked the best ones. It was an a cappella jam session every morning, 15 different niggins up on the steps. So when they start building the Beis HaMikdash and they're done, don't wait. Get here first. We're going to put a secret amp there. We'll be able to hear. We'll pipe the music in. It'll be unbelievable, right? Okay? And as you enter Shar Nicanor, you enter what's called the Azara, known in the Yeshiva Shevelt as the Azara. Okay? The Azara was the courtyard. And in the courtyard, at the northern edge of the courtyard, near the Heichal, near the Beis HaMikdash itself, right, stood the Mizbeach HaNechoshet, the copper altar. And this was a big Mizbeach, and most of the korbanot are pretty much are offered up there. Okay? So it's in the Azara, it's in the courtyard. It's not even in the Heichal itself, it's not in the Beis HaMikdash itself. The Mizbeach HaZahav, on the other hand, that was in the Heichal. That was opposite the Kodesh Kodashim. That was in the actual structure of the temple, in the Kodesh, in the Holy. Right? And does anybody know what significant things, what is the thing they did in Mizbeach HaZahav? They offered up the Ketoret. So that becomes a very important part of the ritual of Yom Kippur. So, for example, if we would call one of those altars Kodesh, and one of them Kodesh Kodashim, which would be Kodesh? The Nechoshet. And which would be Kodesh Kodashim? And you are all wrong. Because the Pasuk says, if you look in, please tell me I marked this, I don't want to have to look for this. Yes. If you look in this week's Parsha, in Perek Chavtet, Pasuk Lamed Zayin, 29:37, Shivat Yamim Techaper Al Mizbeach V'Kidash Tato, this is the Avdei Miluim, this is the how they were dedicating it. Kodesh Kadoshim. Kol HaNogea B'Mizbeach Yikdash. Now nobody touched the Mizbeach HaZahav. This is the Mizbeach HaNechoshet. It's called Kodesh Kadoshim. And by the way, you can find this in another place. Did I mark this? Right? I thought I marked it. Well, if I don't find it right away, I will forget about it. I think it's in Perek Mem. What is in Perek Mem? Yes. Umashachta Mizbach HaOlah Vet Kol Kelah V'Kidash Mizbeach Hayah Mizbeach Kodesh Kodeshim. It's called Kodesh Kadoshim. That's the Mizbeach that you offer up to Ola, which is the same Mizbeach you offer up to Chata, the whole burnt offering, the sin offering, all of them. And it's called Kodesh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies. Right? But the Mizbeach HaZahav, B'kidash Tatov et Kol Kelav Ve'ya Kodesh, is called Kodesh. So how come the Mizbeach HaZahav, which is in the inner sanctum, is called Kodesh, and the Mizbeach HaNechoshet, which is outside, is called the Holy of Holies, Kodesh Kadoshim? Listen to this one. This is unbelievable. Listen to this, Rav Moshe. This is unbelievable. Vaya Mizbeach Kodesh Kodeshim. The Mizbeach. Which Mizbeach? Which altar? Nechoshe. The one that's less holy because it's further out. That's Holy of Holies. Oh, so sweet. Listen to this. Okay? Mash Mizbeach HaNechoshe Nikra Kodesh Kodeshim Shtei Mekamot Kanu Lalan. The fact that the copper Mizbeach, which is more external, is called Holy of Holies. Afshachutz leichal, even though it was outside the mikdash. Umizbech haktoret nikra rakodesh, and the one where the incense is offered, the mizbech hazahav, is called kodesh. Afshamad beheichal neged aron, even though it stood in the mikdash right opposite the ark, opposite the kodesh kodashim. Nireh b'shnei tamim. There are two reasons for this, right? Number one, aleph. Demishema sav bebeit hamidrashim kodesh. Somebody who's in a Beis Medrash and his actions are Kodesh, right? Who are we talking about here? We're talking about you. Somebody who's in a Beis Medrash, his actions are Kodesh, you're learning Torah, we did a number on you. I want you to understand that. When you came in and you walked into this hall and you started learning Torah, you became Bachurei Yeshiva. You now represent something, whether you like it or not. And you are mit asek bakodesh. You are dealing with kedusha, right? Somebody who's inside the Beis Medrash and deals with kodesh, tzarich lirot shemasav chutz lekotlei Beit Medrash, you kodesh kadosh. If in here you're kodesh, out there you have to be kodesh kadosh. You have to be so careful about your actions, our actions out there, because in here we're kodesh. Why? Because you're going to meet people, they don't have the benefit of experiencing the Kodesh. Right? They don't experience Torah, they don't necessarily get to experience Yirat Shamayim in the same way. They're not in a sense of awe, they haven't danced on the rooftops in the Ilan Yom Kippur. They haven't seen what it is to crack a tosos late at night. They haven't heard of Blaushir, whatever it is, right? Okay. The other rabbi shetiyek kedushato gdola shekol nogea bo yikdash. You have to become so kodesh kadosh and so holy outside that instead of you being influenced by people who aren't there, you influence them. That's one reason. And he goes on shiachzuru b'tshuva. We should reach a level. When we come into contact with someone who's never been to yeshiva, who hasn't tasted this holiness, they become holy just by being in our presence. That is a very, very hard place to get to. It's hard to get there because you have to get there without any arrogance. It's hard to get there because you have to get there without any judgment. It's hard to get there because you can't have a goal for people to think you're that. You have to be that. You have to be such an ethical person that people smile just being around you. You have to be such a sensitive person that people feel enriched just by spending time with you. That is a very hard space to reach, right? So therefore, the inner is Kodesh, but the outer is Kodesh Kadosh. Because the goal is not in here, it's out there. That's the first reason. Second reason. And then we're going to put this all together. To mishu Kodesh bebeit midrash bein talmid chachamim nechshav beinei amon ka'am kekodesh kadoshim. I love this piece. Because if you're thought of as Kodesh, look, when we sit in here, let's be honest. You know, I remember, I don't know if you are zoche to feel it the way I felt it, but if you sat in the Beis Medrash in Gush, and Rav Amital is sitting over there, and Rav Lichtenstein is sitting over there, and Moshe Lichtenstein, back then he was Moshe Lichtenstein, just sitting next to you, and Rav Beit Dan's walking around. You know, you know you're sitting with Kodesh Kodeshim, you know you're Kodesh, right? But when you walk out, you forget. That even though you realize you're nothing, because you just spent... You know, I remember I went to Pittsburgh for a year. And it was actually a very dangerous experience, because you actually start to think you know something. Because if you're in a place where, you know, just you're teaching people who don't know that much, you're sharing Torah, you know, you start to think you know something. And my wife did a very smart thing. She said when we came back, she said, you know, you should really think about going back to yeshiva for one more year, because you may never get this chance again. And to go back when you're not studying for smicha and just to sit and learn for no other reason than sit and learn, and I thought that was a really good idea, and I was blessed to have a wife who thought it was a good idea, so we did that. We went back to yeshiva, I think, for a year, year and a half. It was the best year and a half of learning in my life. And one of the healthy things that happened to me that year was I got back and I realized how little I really knew. I went to Gush, and people, like, you know, they own shas, like, you've only been to shas three times, really? You know, like, that's what, they grow on trees over there. So you discover that you're nothing. But that's also dangerous because you forget that when you walk back outside, it doesn't matter that you know you're nothing. They think you're something. And that gives you a responsibility. The world sees you as Kodesh Kadoshim. V'lachein mashgichin alav ma'od v'lomdini ma'asaf. And so they watch you. And they're particular about how you behave. And they learn from what you do. If you come back from yeshiva, They're going to watch you, whether you want it or not. And to the degree that you're a principled person, they're going to value not just who you are, but what you represent. And to the degree that you're not a principled person, they're going to lose respect for what you represent, whether you have anything to do with that or not. And you can't run away from it. It's a part of who you are now. It's a glow that you carry with you. So let's put all this together. Why is this in this parsha? Why is this idea that in here we're Kodesh, but out there with Kodesh Kadashim? That the mincha can be with Shmarim, because that's about my relationship with Hashem. I come to Hashem with all my schmutz. So therefore, the offering can be with pollutants. But the light that I spread, that has to be pure. I have to be not only pure, I have to be perceived as pure. That's a very hard thing to do. Why is that here in this week's parsha? Because why is this parsha, why is this portion, the portion where Moshe's name is not mentioned, and yet this is the portion that is Moshe? Because what do we get introduced to in this week's portion? You know? Very significant part of Judaism. Want to guess?
Yeah.
The kahuna. Parsha Truma is about building the Mishkan. Parsha Tetzaveh, for the first time, we talk about the Shemoneh Yemei Miluim, the consecration, the role of the Kohen comes up for the first time. Now, this is a very difficult experience for Moshe. Because if you study the Medrash, you study the Gemara, Moshe originally was supposed to be Kohen Gadol. Because of something that happens at the burning bush, we're not going to get into right now, he loses that right. And his older brother is going to be the Kohen. This is the first time that Moshe is told, you're not going to be the leader. Not only that, ve'al yavo b'chol et al kodesh, there's going to be a point where you don't get to come in anytime you want. You don't get to go everywhere like Aaron does. Once the Mishkan is consecrated, you can come to the entrance, but you don't go in, you're a Levi. Levi can't go in. This must be so hard. How do you help Aaron become the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and then and just be full of joy for him? Without any jealousy. By the way, who does Moshe learn how to do this from? That's right. Because Moshe says, Shlach na b'yad asher tishlach, at the burning bush, says, why are you asking me to do this? Aaron's been with them, Aaron's there in slavery with them. He should be the one leading them. And that's the only time that Hashem gets angry with Moshe, and he says, what are you talking about? V'nei Aaron achicha yotze likratecha, v'racha v'samach b'libo. Aaron is going to come out, he's going to see you, and he's going to rejoice in his heart. It's interesting, by the way, this is the only time in the entire Torah that it says that someone actually will be happy. And it's said by God, so we have to assume that if Hashem says he's going to be Sameach, he is Sameach. And the only one who could know that someone's Sameach in his heart is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if Simcha is all about purpose, Aaron, seeing Moshe come, understanding that Moshe is going to lead the Jewish people out of Egypt, has not a trace of jealousy. He's just so overjoyed for the gift of his brother coming back, for the fact that his brother will be able to have this role, that the Jewish people, it doesn't even occur to him that he should struggle at all with the fact that he's not going to get to do it. So this is the parsha where we find out that Moshe is the same way. There is not a shemetz, there's not, at least in this parsha, there's not a shemetz, there's not a hint of hesitation here. It's amazing. The essence of Moshe is that it's not about Moshe. That's the essence of Moshe. Ve'akina ve'atava ve'akavod matzim ta'adam min alam. It's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalet. The Rambam's going to quote it in Hilchos Deos, so we're going to get to it. You know what takes you out of this world? You know what ruins your life? Jealousy, appetite, and the pursuit of honor. If you're worried about how people respect you, you'll never get respect. Right? If you run after honor, you'll never find it. If you run away from honor, it will always find you. It's also another Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Here's the trick. You can't run away from honor in order for it to find you. Running away from honor means honor doesn't interest you. Now, you could fake people out, but you can't fake yourself out, and you certainly can't fake Hashem out. The essence of this week's parsha, this parsha is about what's inside of a person. Purity has to come from the inside. If I can get to Kedusha in here, then I can reach Kodesh Kadashim out there. That's the challenge of Tetzaveh. And that has to be at Tzivui. It has to be an imperative. You know? Do we recognize what we're working on here? And what an impact this is going to have? And how much the Jewish community needs this? And how much the world needs this? If you succeed to some degree in becoming a Talmud Chacham, and you succeed to some degree in acquiring, in attaining some level of Kedusha, then you have the ability to bring Kodesh Kadashim out into the world. For people to perceive holiness in ways that they can't imagine. That's a holy light. There's just no other way to look at that. That is a holy light. It's a gift that Hashem has blessed us with. You know, in 2,000 years of Jewish history, millennium, how many people got to learn Torah in the old city of Yerushalayim since the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? You could probably make a list of their names. 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 in Jewish history. In Jewish history, all the Hasidim you heard about in the bells, in the mirror, in Ger, the students who studied in Volozhin and Slobodkin, none of them were zocher to learn in the old city of Yerushalayim. None of them. For some reason, Hashem picked us to be here. Do we realize what a gift that is? We have 3 weeks. In 3 weeks, it's Chodesh Nisan. In 3 weeks, you're going to start to taste that this year is like this. Now, obviously, when you taste that, you realize what you have to do. That's right. Okay? But for the one person who says, I'm so consumed with the responsibility to bring Torah Chutz Lartz, I go back, understand what a challenge that is. That's the message of Parashat Tetzaveh. There is so much more to talk about here. Right? And I think, by the way, this is totally my perception, that Reb Yaakov doing Netilas Yadayim in the morning every day in Auschwitz, it's unbelievable what Kodesh Kadashim, that takes you to a whole different level of what it means to be a person who represents the Holy of Holies. And just anytime you wake up in the morning, you're thinking about doing Netilas Yadayim, whether to put on your tefillin, whether to treat someone with respect, whether to be sensitive, just think that there was a Jew. There was once a Jew who woke up every morning and did Netilas Yadayim and washed his hands in Auschwitz. There's just no words for that. So we're going to...